Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. This month we have with us Fred Siegel. Fred is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, a contributing editor at City Journal. He was a longtime professor at Cooper Union. He is now scholar in residence at St. Francis College in Brooklyn. He also had a career in public service where he worked on the campaign of Rudy Giuliani. He was also a member of the Democratic Leadership Council for many years. The reason to have Fred in right now, I thought, was that a book he wrote that came out 3 years ago was called The Revolt Against the Masses. I presume, Fred, that's a take on the revolt of the elites from many years earlier as well. But the reason that I asked you to come in is because I think that the thesis of that book and the language of the masses, the elites, and the lineage that you draw really from the early 20th century intellectuals up to the present is even more timely now than it was in 2014. So welcome, Fred. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you're writing this book, first of all, 2011, 12, 13, I presume. What prompted you? What brought this issue of the elites, the masses, and so on forward?
In 1989, I'd written a book for Telos magazine. Not a well-known publication, but an interesting publication, entitled, Is Archie Bunker Fit to Rule, or Should John Rawls Be Allowed to Rewrite the Constitution? I may have, the second half maybe, little off. I saw this tension that we see in the Trump campaign. I saw this tension coming in 1989.
The tension between?
Between ordinary citizens and elites, which were becoming increasingly aggressive, increasingly assertive. And Rawlsianism was one part of that assertiveness.
Did you see in Barack Obama's administration a ramping up of the, we'll just call it the reign of the experts over the rest of us?
Very much. But the Obama administration is hard to characterize. Since healthcare aside, where healthcare clearly he was going to provide experts to tell us what was and wasn't worth doing medically, and one of them I'm going to mispronounce his name now, Gerber, I believe, from MIT, said it out loud. You know, we fooled the boobs,
the bourgeoisie.
We fooled the bourgeoisie and. We put this over on them. Well, actually, they didn't. They didn't put it over on them. The average Joe and Jill knew that this was fraudulent. But when you get beyond that, when you get, say, the question of Iran, there wasn't expertise. There was those people who knew something about the subject and knew something about Syria were very much opposed to his policies and understood that they'd be disastrous, as they have been. And from a moral perspective, what we did in Iran and Syria has no precedent. We allied ourselves with a mass murderer, Assad, by supplying his allies, Hezbollah, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, with money, directly and indirectly. So it's hard, yes. Yes, that's true, but also there are peculiar inanities to the Obama administration.
Well, the value of your book, as I looked at it at the time, was to go back many, many decades and find that the increasingly imperious attitude of the intellectuals, the academics, people in media, even in entertainment, had been prepared for. The what you quote a term from Lionel Trilling, which he applied to Henry Adams, patrician condescension. The condescension has a long history here, and you really trace it back to the turn of the century.
But it really takes off in the 20s. And I won't go into the reasons involving Woodrow Wilson, but the key figure in the 20s, and this unnerves liberals, is H.L. Mencken. The founder of modern liberalism is not FDR, it's H.L. Mencken. The founder of statism, governmentalism, yes, is FDR. But the founder of the liberal attitudes we associate with patrician condescension is H.L. Mencken.
We'll continue it. Quick thing. FDR didn't have the condescension, did he?
None, no.
If he passed that, people could sense that. I mean, people do sense when someone holds you in contempt, no matter how well they try to hide it. They know what you think. And I mean, look, you mentioned Archie Bunker. You know, there was a big mistake in the All in the Family show with that theme song. When Archie Bunker and Edith say, "Those were the days, Mr. We could use a man like Herbert Hoover again." Am I wrong to think there is no way in the world Archie Bunker would have been a Hoover guy? He was an FDR guy all the way, yes?
You're exactly right. I mean, Norman Lear was pushing his own ideology to the
right. Right.
Liberals have had a hard time distinguishing between Republicans, free marketers, and more authoritarian constructs. No, FDR. This was true in New York State politics, where he's Al Smith's successor, and national politics. He's not condescending, but H.L. Mencken is all about condescension. It's all about sarcastically putting down the bourgeoisie.
Right.
And Mencken's coverage of the Scopes trial was off the mark. He misunderstood what was happening, but it took hold. It took hold in a popular history, whose name is I'm blanking on, which is written a few years later. In any case, this becomes instantiated. But why does he get it wrong? Well, the reason Dayton, Tennessee has this trial is it wants to get on the map. This is a PR stunt. The ACLU wants us to put itself on the map. The ACLU was founded just after World War I. What about the character of Scopes himself? How was he? He was treated well by his fellow townspeople. He wasn't, the idea that he was
persecuted.
No, nonsense. Just absolute nonsense.
But it fit the drama that Mencken really, really loved to push. I mean, even back to his famous theory of democracy, right?
Yes.
That the people
deserve to get what they want and good and hard.
And get it good and hard, right.
And after the Scopes trial, he writes a book on democracy. One of the very few people who love the book is the Kaiser, who's in exile in Belgium. One of Mencken's friends says of the book, he never should have released this. He revealed too much about himself. You have to remember, Mencken is the first American to write a book on Nietzsche. Well, quasi-American, because he doesn't really consider himself an American. He considers himself superior, a German trapped in an American political culture. And Mencken is wonderful, and he's a lot of fun when you read a short essay by him. But if he's forced to make a coherent argument on a larger scale, it doesn't work. And Mencken's fall comes when he goes at FDR, and he tries to take down FDR. Because Mencken is somewhat of a libertarian. But he's a libertarian with contempt for the masses. And he was the hero of college campuses, of kind of college liberalism in the 20s. He was why you were in college, to rule over these twits.
I can see the college kids liking his famous definition of the Puritan. A Puritan is someone who is terribly worried that someone somewhere is having a good time. There you go. There's the adolescent outlook.
There's enough truth in it that it's not just for adolescents, and Mencken has enough in him to be that's appealing. To go a long way until, and when we get to the 30s, it's not just he first fumbles over at FDR himself, and then when it comes to Germany, he can't bring himself to denounce Hitler, because Hitler's ruling Germany, and he knows Germany is a superior culture. And go ahead.
But in your lineage, the Mencken attitude survives. Even if it's not getting into the White House or into national politics, the stream of condescension, you have some other phrases like hostility to bourgeois life. You quote, even come up with an essay from Slate magazine called Down with the People, that this survives, and that this is a significant stream of progressivism and increasingly liberalism as well.
There's no question about it. This is given another incarnation in the writings of Sinclair Lewis, and when Sinclair Lewis writes it can't happen here, it's not a very good book as a novel, and it's not a very good book as trying to grasp the political life of the country, because right after he writes this, Roosevelt goes through an overwhelming victory. The book doesn't make sense. However, it can't happen here. It gets reissued every decade.
I saw that phrase come up actually last year with Trump's election.
Yes,
it can't happen here. But also the whole Main Street thesis, the babbitry, as well. We have again the contempt for middle class life, for mid cult attitudes, and Lewis, some of the things you quote in there show just how bilious he was toward his fellow Americans. Our first Nobel Prize winner in literature.
Yes, sir. That's a good point.
Yeah.
Yes.
1936, I think.
He's taken to task by a writer who's now forgotten, named Bernard DeVoto.
Great historian.
The great historian.
The Year of Decision, which I think is about 1846.
Yes, exactly. 1846. Yes. It's a terrific book. He writes a number of terrific books. He's not a Mormon, but he understands Mormonism as a kind of collectivism in America. Anyway, DeVoto calls Sinclair Lewis to task. He says, "What's going on here? These people are supposed to be inferior. They're supposed to be debilitated. They're supposed to be supporters of authoritarianism." They go to war in World War II, and they fight wonderfully. And for people who are more highbrow than Sinclair Lewis, there's Eliot writing about the hollow man. These ordinary people go to war and they win it. And at the war's end, there's a discussion of how is it that these people who we know are inferior and problematic, how do they carry out such heroic activities? I speak now with a personal level. My father landed in Normandy the first day, the very first day. Not the first wave, but the first day. So I take this personally. And these guys who come back, and a limited extent gals who come back in the 50s, create the highest popular culture America has ever known. They want to hear classical music. They want to read great books, and they're taken down by people like Dwight MacDonald. Now I knew Dwight, who was a character and a half. For Dwight, these people were by definition inferior. It didn't matter what they did and what had happened. And popular culture, even if it was straining to raise itself, was endlessly problematic. And before I continue with Dwight McDonald, I'll just mention one other person, Susan Sontag. Susan Sontag introduces, in the mid-60s, in Partisan Review, an important magazine, introduces the notion of taste as being at the center of politics. It's not what you believe, it's how you believe it. And so what this ends up producing is people who can be frivolous about high culture, and it's okay because they do it in an ironic style.
Right.
Dwight McDonald is hostile to mass culture, except he then goes on CBS Morning Show in the 60s. he knows which side his bread is buttered on. And when the Columbia 1968 strike occurs at Columbia, he cheers it on, but wistfully. He says at one point, "I like these people, but I wish they read more." He sees what's coming. And
his daughter became a French professor.
Yes.
Christy McDonald at University of Montreal, was it?
I think so.
Yeah, in the post-structuralist world, she made her way. But you know, I'm glad you said that about the 1950s. Fred, because the idea of the 50s as a stale, intellectually stultified world, that's just a creation of the 60s.
That's right.
I mean, and to make fun of projects like Book of the Month Club, because those people out in Omaha belonged to it, the Book of the Month Club selected a pretty darn good list of books. Or things like the Great Books of the Western World Project. Or, you know, one of the most popular radio shows through the 1950s was Texaco's broadcast of the Metropolitan Opera every week. You know, somewhere between 12 and 15 million people in America tuned in to listen to Mozart and Puccini for hours on Saturday. That's about one in 11 or 12 Americans in the country. And then there was even popular music, the Great American Songbook. That was a sophisticated, elegant, refined, developed form of music. And to listen to Dwight McDonald talk about mass cult and mid-cult, I said, Dwight, your contempt is showing here. You want to compare that to what we have today? It looks pretty good from this vantage point.
And at some points, it even got higher and toward high culture. Trilling and Jacques Barzin, and one other fellow I'm forgetting now, started another book club where the books that were selected were even more demanding. And books were central to the culture. My parents were certainly middle-class people. Talk with their friends about books. Andre Schwarzbard, The Lost of the Just, Last of the Just. That set off conversations that I heard for weeks.
You know, I was looking at a photograph I visited in an office last year. Someone had a wide-angle lens photograph, and it was of an arena, a sports arena. There was a big basketball court down on the floor. The photograph was taken way up high, and it could take in all the way around, and the seats are packed. And it's precise enough so that you can see these are all young people. They look like college students. You can see the clothes they're wearing at that time. It's dated 1957, 58, something like that. There is a little podium in the middle of the basketball court, and everything is around there is blank. There is an old white-haired man standing at the podium, and there must be 10 to 12,000 youths in the audience. It's Robert Frost. Now, can you tell me how you could ever have a poet give reading these days? How long has it been since that poet could get more than 100 people in a room on a college campus. This to me is what I remember the 1950s.
That's a marvelously concise way of describing it. And when Toynbee came to speak in America, he similarly drew huge crowds. I forgot whether it was. I think he spoke in a football stadium. I might be wrong about that. That's my memory, that he spoke in a football stadium. You can look back at Toynbee and be very critical of him. I certainly am. But nonetheless, people were hungry for substance. And that was beaten out of them, essentially, by contempt on the part of pretentious people who thought they knew better, but didn't, and gave us the 60s in its most rancid forms.
Now, do you trace a line that runs up to last year's election? Right. I'm sure it's going to be an uneven.
It's an uneven, but it's complicated line. Because the Vietnam War turns the American Protestant upper middle class against its position as leaders of an American elite. The Vietnam War is enormously destructive. Black power and affirmative action is enormously destructive because it undermines the notion of a single standard for all. And the tragedy of this is that at the time when African Americans were being asked, finally, when whites were atoning for their sins, and African Americans were asked to join the society, the attempt was made to fence them off and give them, everyone gets prizes, whether they're deserved or not.
You know, one thing I've often mentioned is, Fred, the word in 1965 was not diversity, it was integration.
Yes.
Right? No more separation. Didn't mean you give up your identity, but you are together. But I haven't heard the word integration in a long time.
Well, there's another word that's important at that time. It's pluralism, which says you can be an Italian American, you can be a Greek American, you can be. What Black Power does is undermine that, because the sense of joining two parts of an identity into a common American identity is done away with, and Black Power suggests multiculturalism, and multiculturalism suggests there's no way to integrate these divergent.
There's no unum underneath the pluribus. That's what. But you know, you go back and you listen to the speeches, which you can get online, the speeches of Stokely Carmichael, others in the Black Power movement. They're very rhetorically powerful. You can see how people got carried away, but it's almost as if the more contempt one can throw at this country, the more this country is going to celebrate you. I mean, this is one of the ironies. You know, Sinclair Lewis can despise the American public, but they're buying his books. They're making movies out of his books, and people are flocking to those movies. You know, Sinclair, I mean, if we followed out your logic, you should be living in a garret starving to death. Not happening.
No, that's a good point. But the celebration of Black Power is somewhat different. What Vietnam does was make it legitimate to be anti-American. The American elites are celebrating that anti-Americanism, and there's a famous dinner party that Tom Wolfe writes about at Leonard Bernstein's, the great composer Leonard Bernstein's house, where America is being described as just a horrible place. And then no one says otherwise. It's described as little short of a fascist dictatorship, a rhetorical trope we're familiar with today. until a Jew who had grown up in Nazi Germany says, wait a minute, what are you people talking about? And it sort of cools things off for a little bit. But part of the appeal of the Black Panthers is stylistic. They're cool.
They walk in with those dark glasses and those leather coats, and Tom Wolfe in the essay Radical Chic describes them and the electricity that all the Park Avenue liberals, Leonard Bernstein and others, are picking up simply by being in the presence of these rogue revolutionary characters. And Wolfe says they played them very, very skillfully.
Bernstein was embarrassed by this later, but he didn't quite understand what was going on. But this is followed by feminism. This is followed by environmentalism and feminism. So you get wave after wave of social movement with contempt for common American life, ordinary American life. Feminism has a whole number of legitimate points it makes. On the other hand, it acts as if women weren't already making enormous gains, as if the population of women in college hadn't dramatically increased already. And now is there are more women in college than there are men.
We're about we're close to 60% of the undergraduate population is female. Women have gotten more PhDs than males for actually many years now. Women are half of medical school students. It's about 50-50. More women went to law school last year than men went to law school. There's only one area, it's really in the STEM, the hard STEM, math, computer science, that are still predominantly men. In my field of literary studies, women have earned 70% of the PhDs in literary studies for many years now. So this is what we see. But we're not going to see the discussions of sexism in the university be going down for a long time.
But the university, what's happened over time is the standing of the universities has just been in a long, slow decline, and now it's hit the rapids.
And partly is because people feel the contempt,
yes,
that academics have expressed toward them for a long time.
Well, it's also that they also feel the sheer silliness.
Well, that's where we are now, yes.
But perhaps politically, the most important of the 60s movements is environmentalism. Because environmentalism insists on things like global warming, which is, would turn out to be wrong. Earth isn't warming. But then it became just climate change. And the current wave of major storms we're facing is going to give this a great revival. But what it does, what the climate change argument does, it makes it hard for people, liberals, to argue in favor of economic growth, economic policies that benefit a broad range of Americans. Instead, what you get is an argument that environmentalism requires constraint. It requires people to reduce their standard of living. Not that Robert Redford or
Al Gore
is going to reduce his standard of living.
Now, is the term climate change denier, is that trying to borrow on the Holocaust denier?
Of course.
Clever.
But it's really not, because the idea of climate change is fairly silly, since the climate is always changing. It doesn't tell you much. The strange thing about Al Gore, and I knew Al Gore in the 90s, when he was talking about reinventing government, and he had some serious things to say. Gore is an intelligent guy, like Clinton. He wasn't an ordinary politician when it came to knowledge. You know what we've seen since then: Bush, Obama, Trump are many steps below Clinton and Gore. but he got caught up in the climate issue in ways that were just irrational. And the country, you know, I don't know how it's going to feel after this wave of storms. I mean, it's now going to be more plausible to argue earthquake in Mexico City, Irma,
hurricanes,
Harvey.
Yeah. Don't forget the eclipse. Can we get the eclipse in there too?
We probably can, but I'm not sure how or why. Unless I want to read Mark Twain.
Well, I mean, sometimes I think that Al Gore snapped after the Florida recount.
It would
be hard not to actually go through that and not be affected for quite a while.
My father-in-law was one of those people who mistakenly voted for Pat Buchanan.
Because of the butterfly?
Because
butterfly ballot, as they called it?
Yes.
Yeah.
He was horrified. But yes, but that a recount, that it looks like Bush did legitimately win by a very narrow margin. But it was the courts first on Gore's behalf and then on Bush's behalf that had the final say. It had a terrible effect on us. But the effect of those movements of the 60s made many people guilty about being American. We use too much fuel. We're not nice enough to African Americans and women. What's happened, I think, and it begins in some ways with McGovern. When McGovern runs for president, he wants the delegate. He's already been a chairman of a commission redesigning the Democratic National Convention. He wants an appropriate percentage of women, an appropriate percentage of African Americans, an appropriate percentage of Latin America, Latinos, et cetera, et cetera. And once that happens, it takes hold on college campuses. And when that happens on the college campus, the ability to have generalized debate without impugning someone or appearing to impugn someone declines. And as that happens, the people who are trained to be leaders of the Democratic Party, who come out of college, early in the century, before Mencken, the founder of liberalism, a man named Herbert Croly, who's the editor of the New Republic, and Croly sees college graduates as our aristocracy. Both Croly and Mencken want an aristocracy, and many of the people who are part of the Democratic Party, who graduate with supposed knowledge, higher knowledge, which is debatable. They see themselves as a would-be governing aristocracy.
You quote the line by the phrase by H.G. Wells, an aristocracy of thought and feeling. Not just thought, but also feeling. I think that's a key component here. People have better feelings than other people.
You're right, Mark. It's that sense of superior feelings that Susan Sontag picks up.
Right.
And I didn't know her well, but I got to talk to her a few times. When I kind of teased her about this, she wasn't buying it. She bristled and essentially told me to go take a flying leap.
She didn't want to hear it.
Neither did now, Dwight McDonald, to be fair to him, was perfectly happy to engage. He was.
It's an older generation. The 60s gave us a whole different sensibility about these, about debate, about disagreement, and when everything's political, then if you don't share the politics, where are you going to meet? Where can you set politics aside for a moment and just, you know, engage as human beings in some way? You don't even have to keep your manners if everything is political.
But while you see the sense of this coming, it really doesn't take hold fully in the 60s. When you get off the campus, the country is quite normal.
Was it the 90s?
By the time you get to the 90s, you begin to see it, but Clinton constrains it. Because Clinton understands that if you push these kind of buttons, you're going to lose. And Clinton wants to win. But if you think what happens between 2000 and 2008, Clinton is pushed to the margins.
Right.
And Hillary, Bill Clinton. Now.
And Hillary knows. Senator Hillary in 2004 was quite a different creature than Hillary 2014, you know, in the cabinet. And then, of course, Hillary, the candidate. Hillary in 2004 never would have made that deplorables remark. She might have felt it. Am I wrong? She would never have said that.
I advise you. I spent days around her. She was still in her listening phase.
Uh-huh.
What got me upset about Hillary was not this. It was more parochial. Is that she? I don't know how many people are aware of the enormous. Let's just say that much of upstate New York is in terrible economic shape. The southern tier is Appalachia, not just metaphorically, but literally. It was part of Lyndon Johnson's Appalachian regional commission. There's terrible poverty there. Hillary said, "I'm going to do something about this." And she did
when she was senator.
When she was running for senator.
Mm-hmm.
These are the kind of words I whispered in her ear. You know, there aren't a lot of votes, but there's a lot of moral capital to be gained from reviving these dead areas. The Hudson Valley is another matter. The Hudson Valley has been colonized by New York, well-to-do New Yorkers. Anyway, she did nothing.
She didn't follow through.
No, she I couldn't vote for her. I mean, when she ran in 2008, I voted for her in the primary, but only because she was running against Barack Obama, who's from Illinois, and as I have relatives from Illinois, and I'd followed his career. I knew that he was a hollow shell. I called him the proleptic candidate. That his promises constituted his politics. And if you look
The Nobel Peace Prize Committee agreed with you.
I'll stop right there.
we won't go there. Well, one final thing, Fred, if we can keep you a few minutes more. Where does the Trump phenomenon, does it fit in all this in any quick way? Or the working class white vote for Trump?
Not in a quick way, but it fits in the sense that Obama gets a free ride for 8 years. The press enlists essentially in the campaign. And it's only Trump who understands that globalization and immigration are the great issues of the day for large parts of the country. Now, some of this is there in 1972, but it's amplified many times over. In other words, the concerns over affirmative action, the idea that whites are privileged, seems inane by the time you get to the Trump campaign. And yet, none of the candidates on either side, except for Trump, and let me say something personal about Trump. I had friends who he stole from, just flat out stole from. So I couldn't vote for Trump. I couldn't vote for Hillary. I stayed home. I think the turnout was very low. I wasn't the only one who stayed home. But the support for Trump comes in part from multiculturalism creating a sense of white identity. White political identity, and many of those whites, not on the coast, were faring badly, and wanted someone who would address their concerns. Trump, you know, Trump has more than a share of failings. We don't have to go into that.
Is his election, does it mean that the progressivist condescension is going to rethink?
No.
And lower the...
No.
No.
Absolutely.
They're raising the... raising the volume.
I spend the winter, because, for health reasons, with my sister-in-law, one of my sister-in-laws, with whom I'm very close, in California, in Los Angeles. And it's quite insane. People who have know nothing about politics feel free to ramble on about Trump's evil. And when you ask them for the specifics, there was one moment, let me just describe one moment. We're in Palm Desert. Some people know this, a well-to-do area.
My mother lived in Palm Desert.
It's beautiful, climate's wonderful. And I asked people sitting around the table, all the three sisters were there, and I asked their friends, what state in the Union has the highest rate of poverty adjusted for income?
Alabama.
That's Louisiana.
Alabama.
No, the answer is California, by far. And so at that point, I was accused of lying. Well,
Right. You're lying.
I'm lying. That can't be true.
The Manhattan Institute, which is probably the leading think tank on poverty in the last 40 years. Yeah?
These people don't know. They don't know from the Manhattan Institute, and they're just angry that someone's saying it. So we pull it up. Yes, it's California by 6 points. Excuse me, I said adjusted for cost of living. It's California by far. At that point, one of the women sitting around the table says, let's talk about Hollywood. Okay,
change the subject.
Evidence is not at issue.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that the only issue at this point, because this propaganda war, this culture war, religious war, whatever, political war that is going on, it's only settled now in this country. It's not settled in arguments. It's not settled in classrooms. It's not settled in the newspapers, in the media. It's only settled now on Election Day. I think that it all just depends on, we're so close in terms of the division in the country. I mean, Trump's a Republican is president. Hillary won the popular vote. We're so close that it just depends on which side comes out on November.
I have my doubts about Hillary in the popular vote.
Yeah.
I mean, in New York, Bill de Blasio, our mayor who recently denounced private property, handed out ID cards to people who were here illegally. How many of them voted? So I don't know what the popular vote was. More importantly, you had in First Things a marvelous essay by Francesca, am I pronouncing it?
Murphy. Yes.
And she said part of the reason that free markets were so important for liberalism is they gave you a fair judge of outcomes. This process worked, this appeal worked, this product worked, and that's important for the country. And we lost that. And so now politics isn't all that concerned with successful outcomes. It's concerned with the imposition of power. And that's ugly. And that doesn't show any sign of easing up.
I hate to end on a pessimistic note, Fred, but I can't disagree with you. Thank you, Fred.
You're welcome.